Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Amy not in studio at the moment. She is making her way to a gas station in Melrose Park. We'll get the exact address. This is part of the Willie Wilson Great Gas Giveaway today, $1 million worth. Hopefully the inclement weather does not dissuade people. I'm sure it won't in Melrose Park. So we'll have some on-site reporting from Amy J as she works her side hustle, which is pumping gas, normally just on the weekends, you know, to make ends meet. But this week, because of the Willie Wilson extravaganza, she'll be out there this morning. Yesterday, day two of Senator querying of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, KBJ, and the focus and some of the tempestuous exchanges on her record adjudicating child porn cases again started with Josh Hawley on Tuesday, continued into yesterday. And Ted Cruz picked up on that, and he provided some additional context that I thought was useful, because some of the defenses of KBJ on the child porn cases was, well, you have to look at the sentencing guidelines, and then you have to look at what other judges have done where the facts in the with respect to the defendant were similar. You have to look at the probationary reports. You know, you have to look at the full context of the decision that she made. It's unfair. Well, here's something else. You know, did she consistently, I guess is the question, impose lighter sentences on child porn offenders than her colleagues? Well, you know what? I was thinking about that before Ted Cruz brought out his whiteboard yesterday. Okay, that's fine. Andy McCarthy, even over at National Review, made that point. Well, that's fine. You know, KBJ gets to answer those questions. So as a diligent jurist, much less second-year law school student, anticipating how you're going to be attacked, if you will, what your opponent is going to say about you, you know, you can also put together your research to make your own case. If it was so clear that her discretionary decisions when it came to sentencing and child porn cases were sort of middle of the road or even better than those of her colleagues, even just in the D.C. circuit, then she can present that evidence in the questioning. She'd say, well, you know, when you look at all the contextual factors, Senator, I'm not that dissimilar from my colleagues when it comes to cases like these that you're raising, where I sentence below the guidelines or even below what prosecutors had recommended. She didn't do that. She didn't do it on Tuesday, and she didn't do it on Wednesday. Ted Cruz and his aforementioned whiteboard, just drilling down the cases where she had discretion and, how she used that discretion.
Let's look at what the prosecutors are asking for. And I would note that this was in the District of Columbia, where prosecutors are far more liberal than many of the prosecutors in this country. And in every case in which, so United States versus Hess, there was a mandatory statutory minimum of 60 months, and you imposed 60 months because you had no discretion. In United States versus Nickerson, there was a mutual agreement of the parties to 120 months, and that's what you imposed. In every other case, United States versus Chazen, the prosecutor asked for 78 to 97 months. You imposed 28 months. 28 months is a 64% reduction.
Let's got a little
in
math
United
class.
States versus Cooper, the prosecutor asked for 72 months. You imposed 60 months. That was a 17% reduction. In United States versus Downs, the prosecutor asked for 70 months. You imposed 60. That was a 14% reduction. In United States versus Hawkins, the prosecutor asked for 24 months. You imposed 3 months. That was an 88% reduction. In United States versus Savage, the prosecutor asked for 49 months. You imposed 37. That was a 24% reduction. In United States versus Stewart, the prosecutor asked for 97 months. You imposed 57. That was a 41% reduction. Every single case, 100% of them, when prosecutors came before you with child pornography cases, you sentenced the defenders to substantially below, not just the guidelines, which are way higher, but what the prosecutor asked for on average of these cases, 47.2% less. Now, you said you made sure the voice of the children.
So 47% less through the cases where she had discretion than prosecutors recommended. Now explain that. Okay, well, here's how she explained it.
A couple of observations. One is that your chart does not include all of the factors that Congress has told judges to consider, including the probation office's recommendation in these cases.
Well, Judge Axel, we don't have those probation. The committee has not been given the probation office's recommendation. We would welcome them. Mr. Chairman, I would love to see those.
The second thing I would say is that I take these cases very seriously as a mother, as someone who, as a judge, has to review the actual evidence in these cases and, based on Congress's requirement, take into account not only the sentencing guidelines, not only the recommendations of the parties, but also things like the stories of the victims.
Yeah, no question. So you take them into consideration and you come in with sentences that are well below the prosecutor's recommendations. She didn't explain that. So, it would have been a useful follow-up, but then they sort of got sidetracked with arguing about time. So do prosecutors know the statutory guidelines, Judge, do you think? Do prosecutors understand what the law is and what judges are directed to do by congressional statute, by federal statute, by Congress-made law? So do they understand that you have to take into account these factors that you say you have to take in? They recognize that, don't they? Of course they do. They know what the guidelines are. It's right there in black and white, right? Of course they do. So how is it that they come to conclusions that on average, where you have discretion, are 47% higher for these cases and these convicted child predators than you do? That's a bit curious, isn't it?
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy out at the BP, or soon will be, the BP station in Melrose Park, 1309 West 25th Avenue. If you want to say hi when you queue up to get your $50 worth of free gas, courtesy of Willie Wilson. We'll have a report from her at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour as she is interacting with the denizens of Melrose Park and the greater West Central Cook County region. So stay tuned for that. We're talking about the confirmation hearing of KBJ, of course. And before we delve a little bit more into day two of Senator questioning, a simple question for you, which is, how do you think the Republican senators did asking substantive questions about KBJ's record and judicial philosophy? And from the answers that were elicited, would you have a problem with a Republican senator who voted to confirm her? I mean, we know what the, I could say the same thing about the Democrat socialists, but we know what they're going to do. This is all baked in. But remember, you've had a Republican senators previously vote to confirm her, like Lindsey Graham, the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who had a testy exchange with her yesterday, his own self, voted to confirm her for the D.C. appellate court. So it's an open question whether he'll vote to confirm her again. So, again, any issues with how the Republicans prosecuted the case in terms of the questioning of KBJ, and any reason why a Republican should vote to confirm her? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Back to the issue of the day yesterday, but I want to get to back to something she said she struggled with on Tuesday, which was, you know, how to define a woman. What's the definition of a woman? She doesn't have a clue, apparently. It's odd. But the child porn sentencing, the cases she adjudicated involving defendants accused of child pornography or worse, and how she came in, as Ted Cruz put on that whiteboard yesterday we were talking about before Mike Scott's newscast, 47% under sentencing recommendations by prosecutors in those cases. And yet she held forth about how heinous and egregious these crimes are. As a mother, she had to endure the evidence in those cases, wrestle with these difficult decisions, these heinous acts against children. Odd that she came down so much lighter than prosecutorial recommendations. She also said in that exchange with Ted Cruz we played, well, you know, you have to look at the probationary reports. Well, we'd love to. We don't have them. If you could produce them, get the probationary office in D.C. to produce them, we'd be happy to look at them. Well, Josh Hawley actually picked that up in his questioning. He started it yesterday. He continued it yesterday. Hawley picked up on that, you know, in the Hawkins case that he focused his attention on Tuesday, they have the probationary report. Prosecutor recommended 24 months. You sentenced 3. What did the probation office recommend? 6 times the sentence that you imposed. They recommended 18 months. So how do you square that, since one of the factors you say you need to consider is the probationary report? You still came in at 1/6 of the recommendation of the probation department. Do you regret it?
Let me ask you about the Hawkins case. You and I talked about this yesterday. You've been able to think about it overnight. This is a case where you had an 18-year-old who possessed and distributed hundreds of images of 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds, and you gave him, frankly, a slap on the wrist sentence of 3 months.
Senator,
do you regret it?
I don't remember whether it was distribution or possession in the law.
It was both. Do you regret it?
In the law, there are different crimes that people commit.
Judge, you gave him 3 months. My question is, do you regret it or not?
Senator, what I regret is that in a hearing about my qualifications to be a justice on the Supreme Court, we've spent a lot of time focusing on this small subset of my sentences, and I've tried to explain.
You regret that we're focusing on your cases? I don't understand.
No. I'm talking about the fact that you're talking about
child pornography
seven
cases?
Very serious cases.
I'm glad we agree on that. Don't you think
some of which involve conduct that I sentence people to 25, 30 years.
3 months before. In this case, Judge. Do you regret it? You haven't answered my question yet.
Senator,
do you regret the sentence?
Senator, I would have to look at the circumstances. What I'm telling you...
You know the circumstances. We discussed it for half an hour yesterday. There's a 55-page transcript, which I'm sure you've read. You lived it. As you've emphasized to this committee over and over, you've lived it, right? You said that you've been through all of this. You've looked at all of the images. You're the one who's had to endure all of it. You gave him a 3-month sentence. I just wonder if you regret it or if you stand by it. I mean, do you stand by that sentence?
Senator, in every case, I followed what Congress authorized me to do in looking to the best of my ability at all of the various factors that apply, that constrain judges, that give us discretion, but also tell us how to sentence. And I ruled in every case based on all of the relevant factors.
So you don't regret it?
No one case, Senator, can stand in for a
judge. I'm not asking you that. I'm asking if you regret this sentence in this case. And it sounds like the answer is no. But I want to tell you I regret it.
Mm-hmm. And her words at sentencing, Josh Hawley went back and looked at the record, and here's what KBJ had to say as read back to her. And then she imposes a sentence that's 1/6 the recommendation of the probation department, 1/8 the recommendation of prosecutors.
I regret that you gave him only 3 months. Let me read to you what you said about these kinds of cases, and in fact, to this defendant. You said, "Make no mistake, Mr. Hawkins, the children you saw in those pictures were not willing participants in the conduct that you witnessed. They were being forced to commit unspeakable acts of sexual violence for the pleasure of the person who was filming and for the gratification of sick people everywhere, people who apparently have no shred of empathy for what this must be doing to the children who are being abused in this way." You go on. "Some of the children you saw in those pictures will never have an adult, a normal adult relationship. Some of them will turn to drugs and prostitution and other vices to try to deal emotionally with the pain that results from the torture that they have experienced. And even those who manage to lead a somewhat normal adult life say they live in constant fear of being recognized. Some people are even unable to leave their houses because once those pictures are on the internet, they are there forever. And the victims can't do anything without worrying that every person that they meet has seen them in their most vulnerable state at the most horrible time in their lives." That's your words, pages 34 and 35, the transcript. Powerful words, Judge. I just don't understand why, after saying this and believing this, you could give this guy 3 months in prison when the probation office that we've heard so much about recommended 18 months. Even the probation office recommended 18 months. Do you have anything to add?
No, Senator.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do you have anything, Dad? She got a little frustrated there, feeling like she's being treated unfairly. And that will, of course, signal the jackals of the D.C. press corps to rally to her defense. They're already doing it. Ivy Harris, who is a client advocate for Partners for Justice within the Compton Public Defender's Office in L.A. "Black women have been bracing for impact during Ketanji Brown Jackson's hearing. We know all too well the tightrope we walk in predominantly white institutions. One wrong step and our intrinsic value is weaponized against us." It's so harrowing. She's been through it, confirmation hearings twice before. She's a Harvard law grad, smart woman. One wrong step, she's walking a tightrope and our intrinsic value is weaponized against us. No, your record may be used against you in a confirmation hearing. But of course, a sophisticated jurist like Ketanji Brown Jackson knows that. She just doesn't have particularly compelling answers to the questions that are being posed. So that's the problem. The other problem is when she got frustrated trying to explain herself, as a number of senators came at her on this topic, she offered a rather troublesome, excited utterance that will, I won't say haunt her. It's not going to jeopardize her confirmation, of course, because that's a done deal. But it is memorable. It'll be right there alongside the, I don't know, the definition of a woman statement. This is KBJ and Lindsay.
"In comes the internet. On the internet, with one click, you can receive, you can distribute tens of thousands, You can be doing this for 15 minutes, and all of a sudden, you are looking at 30, 40, 50 years in prison.
Good.
Cut.
Good.
I understand.
Absolutely
what
good. I hope you are.
To do
good.
Allow her to finish, please.
I hope you go to jail for 50 years. If you're on the internet trolling for images please. Of children in sexual exploitation. So you don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a
that's
horrible thing.
That's not what the witness said, and she should be allowed.
She should be allowed. Well, she is allowed to respond, Sacca Durbin. 15 minutes and you can go to jail for 30, 40, 50 years. Oh, because the internet makes accessing child pornography easier, distributing child pornography easier? Yeah. Mm-hmm. 15 minutes and you can go away for your life. Well, I guess it really matters what you do in those 15 minutes. You don't accidentally traffic in child porn, do you, Judge? People use the internet every day. I would say the overwhelming majority, the 99th percentile, and never view or traffic in child pornography. So what does the internet have to do with it? Decisions that were made and the vehicle to engage in that criminal conduct is more readily available than it was pre-internet. But so what? What does that have to do with anything? 15 minutes and it can change your life. Yeah, we know that. 15 minutes, you carjack somebody. You get in a shootout on the Dan Ryan. You open fire in a movie theater or a concert in Las Vegas or a school. It can change your life. 15 minutes. What the hell does that have to do with anything? What kind of statement is that for a judge to make? Oh, I was just doing wrong for 15 minutes. I shouldn't go away for life. It really depends on the nature of the wrong, doesn't it, Judge? But it's a tell as to the mentality. Let's give him a break. You know, people forget all the good things that this child sex predator did in his life. Shouldn't be the end of his life. Shouldn't go away for 18 months, 24 months, much less 30 or 40 or 50 years, if I have discretion, says Judge KBJ. Mary Ellen in Crete, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
What would motivate her to issue these sentences so below what the sentencing, you know, discretions were? I don't get it.
It's a great question. Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks for the call, Mary Ellen. I think there's a couple things. I think she is a product of the identitarian left, and this would sound insane to say, except we've presented on this show over the years op-eds in support of what I'm about to say. There are those on the left that want to mainstream pedophilia, that don't think that adult-child relationships are wrong, or certainly they don't think they should be illegal. It's a fact. Even our very own Republican, whatever that passes for in Illinois, Senator Mark Kirk, in his support of marriage redefinition, life is all about who you love and who loves you back. Without qualification, without any bright lines. I mean, of course, there's these ghoulish, disgusting associations that exist in this world, like NAMBLA. There have been defenses of pedophilia in outlets like Salon. Left-wing rag. So there's that aspect of it. The final frontier of destroying the sanctity of the family, the separation of the state and the protection of children by both family and state, separation of the state from the business of protecting children, is the sexualization of children, which is why we place so much emphasis on it when it comes to the sexualization curricula in, forget K through 12, how about pre-K through 3, as in the case in Florida that's being battled out right now. That's a part of it. Here's another part of it. John Schweppe tweets about this at the American Principles. He's American Principles Project. He tweeted yesterday, I'm tempted to share a dirty little secret about D.C. that would explain why many on the right are basically cheerleading KBJ's nomination. One of the most well-funded issue spaces on the right is criminal justice reform. And KBJ's policy differences with the sentencing guidelines is something that a lot of these conservative or libertarian people agree with. That's why you're seeing so many folks upset about the pedophile talk. They don't like to talk about pedophiles, the rapists, the murderers. Criminal justice reform is only about those poor kids who get caught with an ounce of weed, remember? But it's not, of course. This is an example of how it's not. Cato Institute, libertarian think tank, endorsed KBJ's nomination. America is the most carceral nation on the planet. We lock up both a larger proportion and a higher absolute number of our citizens than any other country, and so on and so forth. In defense of their position in criminal justice reform and, by extension, support for KBJ's nomination. The Koch Institute's number one issue listed. You know, the Koch brothers, the shadowy lurking figures that are funding a conservative revolution in this country. Hardly. Leftist boogeyman politics. If only the Koch brothers were funding a real conservative revolution or part of the funding of a real conservative revolution, conservative reform revolution in this country. If only they were. They're not. Number one issue on their website, criminal justice reform. I know the Step Up Act thing that Trump signed, bipartisan support, a lot of support from the black community. That was popular, and there's some good aspects of it and that conversation. We should always be thinking about our criminal justice system and whether it's fair and how it can be improved. It is not something that should go unexamined. But Schweppe is right when he suggests that criminal justice reform across the board is sold as 10-year minimum mandatories for marijuana smokers, when that's not really what the impetus for the movement is, and that's not really what there's opposition to. What there's opposition to is the sort of latitude given judges like KBJ to sentence a individual who is viewing and distributing child pornography to only 3 months in prison. Jeff in Lincolnshire, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Tony.
Oh, all right, Tony.
I was calling in about, that's a long story there, but I understand the mix up. If she felt intimidated and emotional on the stand from that little line of questioning, how do you think Judge Kavanaugh felt when people literally came out of the woodwork with proven fabricated stories, protesters pounding on the doors of the chamber? This is a clown show now. This has gotten ridiculous.
Oh, there's no question about it. Thanks for the call, Jeff. I mean, you heard on Mike Scott's newscast, Cory Booker's waterworks. Come on. How performative. Karen in Beecher.
Oh, Dan, Congress made me do it. My goodness, if I hear that one more time out of her mouth, I am going to spit wooden nickels. And I'm sure that's the excuses I'm going to hear from my students at school when I ask them, what are you doing? Oh, Congress made me do it.
Right. Thanks, Karen. It's pretty good. Yeah. One other thing, too, but before we leave this topic. You know, you need to be a biologist to know what the definition of a woman is. It's interesting. She used woman a lot in her testimony. Roe and Casey are set a law of the Supreme Court concerning the right to terminate a woman's pregnancy. The right to terminate a woman's pregnancy is fundamental. I'm humbled and honored to have the opportunity to serve in the capacity and to be the first and only black woman to serve on the United States Supreme Court because I am a woman and because I'm a black woman and so on and so forth. So I hear that a lot. So she uses a word that she doesn't know what it means. But I'm glad, actually, that she wants to defer to biologists, particularly on the matter of life. We had him on the show back in 2019 when he published his research. Stephen Jacobs, who's with Illinois Right to Life and PhD from University of Chicago. If you'll recall, he did a project where he asked 5,577 biologists from universities around the world. 96% of those 5,577 biologists who responded to him on the question of when life begins affirmed the view that a human life begins at fertilization. I wish somebody would present that to KBJ.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as we're finding out, not finding out, we're being reminded during the confirmation hearing of Ketanji Brown Jackson, which, of course, was telegraphed in advance of her hearing. Frankly, it was telegraphed in advance of her nomination when the big guy established the race and gender litmus test for his selection. Everything's racist. To question a judge on her sentencing choices when it comes to convicted child sex offenders, it's racist if that judge is a black female. Mm-hmm. Everything's racist, including tipping, it turns out. This was brought up, Nicole Hannah-Jones, not tipping, in the confirmation hearing. Because of Ketanji Brown Jackson's support for critical race theory in speeches at law schools, in the curriculum at Georgetown Day School, where she's a board member, and the 1619 Project is basically part of the curriculum, the rewriting of American history. Nicole Hannah-Jones tweeting out, tipping is a legacy of slavery. And if it's not optional, then it shouldn't be a tip, but simply included in the bill. Have you ever stopped to think why we tip, like why tipping is a practice in the United States and almost nowhere else? Mm-hmm. Tipping is racist. Well, that's good news. I can't wait to share this with those in the service industry in which I come into contact with who are black. I can't wait to tell them the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah-Jones, and all the identitarians and race hustlers on the left. And I repeat myself. They think if I give you, 25% on this tab, that I'm extending the legacy of slavery. So what do you want me to do here? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. I certainly don't want to insult anyone or be accused of propagating the legacy of slavery by tipping people of color. Do I? Do you? Huh. Boy, it's going to make going out to eat a lot cheaper. Thank you, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Home appraisals are racist. Kamala Harris, in between her work to find the root causes of our problem at the southern border and negotiating peace in Eastern Europe, she is combating racism in home appraisals. The Biden administration is going to work to increase oversight of the home appraisal industry, provide more information to homeowners on how to challenge low valuations, prevent bias in algorithm-based valuations, and create more diversity in the appraisal industry because it's 97% white. So what you have with home appraisals, it's an industry that's dominated by honkies, and then those honkies inflate the value of honky homeowners and artificially reduce the value of non-honky homeowners. So I don't know if anybody in the appraisal industry would like to call in with an apology, but we're willing to accept them. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The median white family in America holds 8 times the wealth of the typical black family and 5 times as much as the typical Latino family, much of which is due to higher ownership rates, higher home ownership rates, and higher property values. Huh. Point of order. Can you tell us, Kamala, you know, whoever, the disparity between the typical black family and the typical Latino family? A 3X disparity. Gosh, why is that? Interesting. Also, when it comes to property values, I mean, seeing as we're here in Chicagoland where we enjoy the highest property taxes in the nation, and boy, we really do enjoy them because we continue to promote people who institute them. So, I mean, we do like it, no question. But what about property tax rates in the poorer communities in, say, a Cook County? Cook County is a real case study, isn't it? Particularly the Southland, South Cook County. We've talked about it before. Where is the property tax rate the highest as a percentage of home value in Cook County? Fort Heights, one of the poorest communities in Cook County and, frankly, the country. 99% black. So is that a result of racism in the appraisal industry, you think? The fact that you've got a $6,000 tax bill on a $60,000 house, which is about the going deal in Fort Heights. I mean, the homes are, the market value is zero, but, you know, that's the sort of stated value on the basis of the Cook County assessor's imposition of the property tax. You want to talk about property taxes and how that impacts home ownership in a place like Cook County, dominated for half a century by Democrat socialists, and in the last decade plus, largely by black Democrat socialists? What's going on here? Institutional racism? So tipping is racist and home appraisals are racist. And getting ripped, you know, lifting weights, that's white supremacist. Yeah. The fitness freaks out there, there's a worry that white supremacy has reared its ugly head with these fitness freaks. Researchers reported that a network of online, quote, fascist fitness, unquote, chat groups on Telegram are recruiting and radicalizing young men with neo-Nazi and white supremacist extremist ideologies. Well, you know who else liked to lift weights? Hitler. So lifting weights, if you're white, you're probably being radicalized by a neo-Nazi online. You're going out and you tip a black waitress or waiter that's perpetuating slavery. You get your house appraised by a honky. That's you and you with a honky and some other honky conspiring to depress the home values of black Americans. Just can't get away with it. And then if you work at Home Depot and you go into the lunchroom, you're treated with leading practices, unpacking privilege. This is found at the employee lounge at Home Depot. Home Depot in Calgary, Alberta, that is. Home Depot, founded by Bernie Marcus, Ken Langone. I mean, great entrepreneurs. I know they're out of the company now, but just shows you if you don't take it decidedly at the institution and its guarantors don't take a decidedly small-C conservative perspective, it will become a haven for Marxists over time. It's like, you know, allowing your house to be infiltrated by pestilence. This is again in the lunchroom, and it's one branch. Home Depot responded to this, but we'll get to the response in a second. A checklist for those who are white, male, Christian, cisgender, able-bodied, and heterosexual, helping them unpack their privilege. Some of the privilege warnings in the packet. If while growing up, college was an expectation of you, not a dream, class privilege. If you can use public bathrooms without stairs, fear, or anxiety, you have cisgender privilege. If you don't have to worry about how to get into a store, you have able-bodied privilege. If you don't have to explain that your spouse is of the same gender, you have heterosexual privilege. And you can sort of paint by numbers and follow where it goes from there, I'm sure. It's just everywhere. Everything is racist. Or, you know, an expression of some sort of privilege that basically, once you break it down, gets you back to that same thing, you know, the problem with the honkies. Phil and Darian, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on your repeated use of the word honky. It's pretty funny. I had a good laugh here in the car traveling to work.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering to myself, why is the white race the only race that is allowed to have a nickname? If you have a nickname for any other race, you're of course a racist. And why is the left so forceful of the word equity until they're forced to be equitable? I'm wondering about that stuff.
Thanks for the call, Phil. Well, who made it okay for me to use the term honky? George Jefferson on the Jeffersons. That's who. And if Sherman Hemsley can enjoy the use of that word, then certainly I can. And I appreciate his leadership on the issue. Harry, Tinley Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan. Been in the appraisal industry for about 35 years now.
35 years of undervaluing the homes of black and brown people, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Dan. This is another case of where there's some isolated cases where things weren't done properly, and the government jumps in and tells us there's a systemic problem throughout the industry. This has been in the appraisal publications for about a year now, where there have been a few isolated cases where people just flat out did a bad job. There is a process to get rid of these people. All states have an appraisal board where people get reported and suspended and fined for this type of thing. And as far as our job goes, it's a pretty basic approach. We see a home, and then we come back to our office and try to find homes that are comparable to that in that neighborhood. So we can't control what pricing is in specific market areas. The market does that. So as long as someone's doing their job, and it's a kind of basic in nature, this isn't a huge problem. There's probably been a few isolated cases where somebody did a really bad job.
So what I hear you saying is that you take a look at the race of the homeowner. You go home, you go online, you get into one of your neo-Nazi chat groups, you pump some iron, and then you file a below market value appraisal for the home of a black or a brown person. Is that what you're saying?
I think what you hear is exactly what Kamala heard. Yes.
Let me ask you a question, though, a serious question. Since you've been in it for so long, and you know, they're always the identitarians, the race hustlers, they're always hearkening back to an era that no longer exists, because that's what they need to sustain their scam. So it's always 1965 Selma for them. And it's always, yeah. And when it comes to home ownership and this issue of discrimination, when it comes to home values, access to credit, so forth, redlining. So to talk to me about what your experience is as perhaps a witness to anything resembling the redlining that they speak of going back four decades that led to the Community Reinvestment Act as the federal response. And now we're getting another federal response. What it was like, say, when you started versus what it's like today. If there were some legitimate grievances systemically four decades ago that are no longer legitimate today.
I think, Dan, 35 years I've been involved, it's more or less, I consider it kind of the modern era of what we do. And the approach that I spoke of to you has been around for a very long time. In terms of, there's generally criteria for collecting data. When you mentioned redlining, we don't define neighborhoods by the railroad tracks, the factory, these type of things any longer. What we do is we try to find properties that are considered, in homogeneous areas. So if I happen to get in a neighborhood where I don't have a lot of data, I get to the next area that's similar in nature, and I gather that data. So, these things that existed, I'd say the last of what you're talking about might be the 70s, in my industry, perhaps, but I haven't seen that. There was a push in the 80s to not only try to do things on a par in our business, but, credit agencies started scoring so that people were going to be treated, based on their payment histories and whatnot, where it wasn't subjective anymore. And that's why, credit reports didn't have scores, 35, 40 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Now they do. So all these things were done to try to create the balance, which is obviously fair and should be done. So I don't think anything of what's been talked about now has been around for maybe 60s and 70s, but I don't know, since the 80s, I'm sorry, I don't see it.
And what about the issue I raised, too, the confiscatory property taxes, like in Cook County, and particularly like South Cook County, and how that impacts property values?
It's a sin, Dan. It's an absolute sin. When we get out to, there were towns that, I grew up on the south side of the city, and I always wanted to, when we traveled south to the burbs and I played ball games, on traveling teams, I thought, oh man, Homewood and Flossmoor and Olympia Fields, this is where I want to be. These are the towns, this is gorgeous out here. And these towns are, these properties are actually, property values are getting gouged. You own a $400,000 property out there and you have a $14,000 tax bill, $15,000 tax bill. So those values aren't going to go up. They're just getting eaten up by property taxes. So it's horribly unbalanced. And you're right. If they want to address a problem that's affecting minorities, address that one.
Thanks for the call, Harry. Appreciate your expertise on the topic. Marty in Naperville.
Good morning. One word, Dan, I got to tell you that everybody, that's a real buzzword, is the word of. Because if I can call somebody a person of color, that's fine. If I call somebody a colored person, it's not fine.
All right. We've updated our lingo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a connotation to a time period, which I understand. And that's why I wouldn't use that term either.
I understand it, too, but it's a word. And albeit maybe, I'm not one that's going to be able to figure out how someone would be offended by it because I'm not a person of color. But bottom line is I think it's getting a little out of hand with, like you said, just because I'm married, that means that, I am privileged to be married to a female.
Yeah, you've had heterosexual privilege.
Everything is labeled.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Marty. Yeah, I'm surprised nobody picked up on the tipping thing. This was a perfect time to finally offer a defense to Scottie Pippen. The reason that he doesn't tip is because it's a legacy of slavery, like Nicole Hannah-Jones says. Finally, we've got a defense for Scottie.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. She's not here. She's in the field. She's at the BP station in Melrose Park, 1309 North 25th Avenue, if you want to stop by and say hi and have her pump $50 worth of free gas courtesy of Willie Wilson into your car. She has been out there talking to folks about Willie Wilson's great gas giveaway, and here's some of what they had to say. This is a woman named Rosa.
This is Rosa from Franklin Park?
Yes.
All right, so you're in Melrose Park. What time did you get here?
About 10 to 5.
Were you surprised nobody else was here?
There were just a few cars, so I was very surprised, yes.
But why $50? I mean, are you burning more gas waiting to get gas?
I don't think so. I mean, look, I took advantage of it. Everything's gone sky-high prices. So if I can get some free gas, I'm going to take advantage of that.
Yeah, but Rosa was about an hour and 10 minutes early. That's why nobody was there. It starts at 7 o'clock, doesn't it? I think so. A couple more of Amy's interview subjects.
All right, why is it so important for $50?
Because, the economy is bad, you know. I'm not working right now, and this is why I'm here, to try to save some money.
Reasonable.
Last time we just heard that people started lining up overnight, and we decided to just, we live around the corner, so we're like, 3 a.m. sounds like a reasonable hour, so yeah, we got here at 3 a.m. Yeah, a little bit after 3.
What do you want to say to Dr. Willie Wilson?
Thank you. It's it's a good help, especially for me. I work in Elk Grove Village, so it is quite a drive from here to Elk Grove. And gas prices ain't cheap here or there. So thank you. Thank you very much.
I think that was our general sales manager driving to Elk Grove Village. Oh, okay. Now let's join Amy J. in Melrose Park. Lining up at 3 a.m., did they not get the memo that this thing starts T-minus 18 minutes?
I know. It is. I've gone by 3 gas stations on the way here that are giving the gas giveaway. Dan, I can't believe the lines. I mean, first of all, I started at Irving and Western, and that line went all the way down Western, wrapped around Grace for 2 miles. It's kind of sad how desperate people are and how, you know, every penny counts right now. So then I went from there to another station. Here, I finally ended up here, and the line goes from 25th Avenue all the way down to 11th Avenue. I talked to the Melrose Park Police Deputy Police Chief, and he said, you know, they haven't had any fights so far, but they're here, and there's public safety officers here that volunteer to just keep things in order. But it's a traffic mess anywhere around these 46 gas stations that they're doing the gas giveaway. I would completely avoid if I was driving in my car.
So,
but these people, you know, go on.
Well, so the people in line at Melrose Park, I mean, how are they passing the time? Did anybody bring a sausage sampler or something for people to enjoy while they wait for their gas?
No, something. I mean, I woke a couple up. They were sleeping in the car, that couple that you heard that's been here since 3 a.m. They were watching a movie. And then they fell asleep, and they had a little bit of a breakfast. But yeah, they're. It's just so sad that it's come to this, that people are, you know, desperate. They're desperate for food. They're desperate for gas. Anything helps this economy.
I
feel like saying Joe Biden did this.
Yeah, well, put some stickers up, and we got to have the. But you need the Biden and Pritzker here because Pritzker doubled the state gas tax. Are you telling people that you can thank Governor Pritzker for the high price of gas because he doubled the state gas tax?
Well, I'm going to when I start pumping. I talked to the BP owner here.
Okay.
And they only have 3 people pumping gas. And I said, well, you know, he's got 5 pumps. I can help out. And he said, that'd be great. And guess what? He's going to give me a cup of coffee.
What about how about some beef jerky? How about, you know, you can get anything from the impulse buy shelf, right? What about that? You know, the checkout line. So the BP. Where's Willie's not there with you? No,
Willie's in Cicero. He's at the station in Cicero, and I wanted to go to a gas station that, you know, more people like me would hang out at, and just a place where not media is. You know, at Western and Irving Park. Every TV station is there because every station is close to there because they're lazy.
Because they're easy, of course. So now,
every single station was there. It was ridiculous.
Are you Willie's bag man? Did you bring the cash to pay for all this gas?
No, I don't know how this is working, but the pump, each pump cuts off at 50, and then the next car has to come through. But each station can service 400 cars, which means how many cars are going to get serviced, Dan?
Let's see, 400 cars. How many stations? How many stations? I don't know, 10 stations?
47 stations.
Oh, 47.
All between Chicago, the south suburbs, west suburbs, and some of the northern suburbs. Yeah, 47 stations. Each station is going to service 400 cars.
Well, right. So that would add up to about the 20,000 that the $1 million would cover, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's it.
So with respect to the station, you talked to the BP owner there at 25th Ave and Melrose. So they were in communication. They knew about this. It's not a surprise to them that there's this queue getting into their gas station.
No, they knew about it, and their phone is ringing off the hook because people are complaining that they can't get out of their driveways, they can't get onto the street, and they're a little, their panties are in a little bit of a bunch right now, if you know what I mean. Any help they can get, they'll take it.
And are the cops out there directing traffic, or are there cops? Is there police presence?
There's volunteer public safety officers that are here, and then Melrose Police Deputy Chief is here. He's walking around making sure everything's okay. But so far, so good. No fist fights yet. No fender benders. And that's what they're, trying to do and make sure everybody stays in order and no cutting in line. Because the BP owner told me, too, that people are calling, giving plate numbers out, saying, this guy with plate number 21735. I know. Yeah.
You can't buy, that's what they should have done. You should be able to buy like that, like at Disney, where you can buy that pass where you can circumvent the line.
Flash pass.
Yeah, could have done a flash pass deal there too. Maybe Willie can pay for.
I got to tell you, the exhaust is mind blowing because everyone's running their cars because it's getting cold out.
Yeah.
So no one's put it in park, if you know what I mean. That's what I would have done.
So are you taking everybody out to Tom's Steakhouse for lunch after this, or what's the plan?
No, the plan is I'm going to pump some gas and then come back to the station.
All right, and so. Are you talking? I know we've got some of those interviews you did that we just played, but there's a lot of character and characters in Melrose Park, and I just wonder if you've been soliciting any material for the roast tonight from the people you're speaking with.
Oh, one of the police officers here asked me if I was ready for the roast.
Yeah,
and I said, "Well, do you got anything for me? Here's a piece of paper and a pen. Write it down." I was up all night. This is actually the worst homework assignment I've ever had, is to do this roast for you. And I'm going to nail it, though. I've got the outfit ready.
Oh, good.
I've got that.
Are you wearing it? Are you wearing it at the gas station? You're wearing it at the BP station? Are you in full battle regalia?
No, I don't have it. I'm not wearing that now because I'm saving it for you.
And in the interest of propriety and full disclosure and corporate payroll restrictions and so forth, there wasn't a old Dodge Caravan with an Iowa Hawkeye sticker that's first in line, that you see first in line there for the free gas by any chance?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. All right.
No, I wouldn't stoop.
If that's the way you want to play it, that's fine.
Well, okay. I did think about it. I thought, a little something for the effort, but they're going to give me a cup of coffee instead. Oh, some cars are moving right now. Okay. I think we're going to get this started pretty soon. They're lining up in a different line now.
Are you telling people that, that they wouldn't have this problem if they would just do what Pete Buttigieg said and go out and buy a $90,000 Tesla?
Yeah, right. All these hardworking blue-collar Americans who, there's a lot of work trucks here. And they said, why not? I told my boss I'd be an hour late for work because I need the $50 to get to work and back for the week. So, I'm going to let them know that Pritzker doubled their gas tax.
Yeah.
And Mayor Pete celebrated when he said he froze it until July. And Mayor Pete says, go get a bike or a Tesla.
Yeah. That's nothing in between. You either bike to work or you buy a $90,000 electric car. Nothing in between. And that's the Democrat socialist that you love, by the way. I think Melrose Park is represented by Democrat socialists. Interesting. You might want to remind them of that, too. All right. Do some reminding.
I'll remind them.
Do some pumping. If you need a emergency evac, we'll send the AM560 chopper out your way. So just let us know.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Let us know if you've got any fun stories from the front here on the Willie Wilson Great Gas Giveaway Day.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, all right, get a couple calls in. Some reaction to Amy's Man on the Street interviews at that BP on 25th Ave in Melrose Park. Tony Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. I got to thank you for bringing back the levity and the everyday grind of the stuff we keep hearing. I was going by that gas station and I seen, it's like the morning zoo, right? I seen Amy out there pumping gas. I seen Piranha Man handing out donuts and Johnny B was dropping a car off a crane on 25th Avenue.
And
beautiful. I love it.
And I'm doing the show in a straitjacket right now, like Murph in the morning.
Right. There you go. There you go. Beautiful. Thanks for the morning's due, my friend. Have a good day.
Thanks, Tony. Jim, St. John, Indiana.
Dan boy, you know Sharon and I never miss an answer event. You are her hero. But anyway, had we been there tonight, I saw something, I guess online, that goes in the Wayback Machine. According to your doctor, when you were born, you were so freaking ugly, he didn't know which end to slap. So he just slapped your mother.
Okay.
Anyway, that's my roast. Hey, Dan, my book's going to be published. We're donating everything to Fisher House.
Oh, great. Okay, thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. And I'll pass along that material to Amy, see if she wants to incorporate that into her Don Rickles impersonation tonight. Speaking of trying to help Amy, I think, you know, you go back to the standards. You go back to your Don Rickles, as I just mentioned. You go back to your Dean Martins. You go back to your Bob Hopes. You go back to your Ronald Reagans. And couldn't be more timely, given what's happening with the former Soviets in charge of Russia. Here's another great Reaganism, you know, from a bygone era.
The story was an American and a Russian arguing about their two countries. And the American said, look, in my country, I can walk into the Oval Office, I can pound the president's desk and say, Mr. President, I don't like the way you're running our country. And the Russian said, I can do that. The American said, you can? He says, yes. I can go into the Kremlin, to the General Secretary's office, pound his desk and say, Mr. General Secretary, I don't like the way President Reagan's running his country.
I wish the Gipper was alive to roast me tonight. That would have been a treat. Of course, he would have never done that because I'm insignificant. But still, it's a dream. You're allowed to have dreams.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Put Boston Mayor Michelle Wu on the list of noxious mayors, and you won't be surprised if you remember. Talked about her before on the show. Raised in Barrington, went to Harvard, now became the mayor of Boston after the previous dude was elevated to be the Labor Department Secretary or something. I mean, who cares, really? What's the point? You know, got a sinecure, got parachuted out of Boston to D.C. Anyway, Michelle Wu is one of the new generation of just really unrepentant and detestable identitarians. She offered this little riff in the direction of first responders. It's very interesting. Big city mayors seem to have a real problem with first responders, including Eric Adams in New York City, even though he's former NYPD, and even though he's moving, it seems, to reinstitute broken windows. We'll get to him in a second. First, Michelle Wu.
Over 100 days, we have connected unhoused residents at Mass and Cass to housing, treatment, and services. We've launched 3 free bus lines. We've taken some big, bold actions, but I won't lie. This past winter was pretty intense. Trial by snow, trial by fire, fighters union. I'm getting used to dealing with problems that are expensive, disruptive, and white. I'm talking about snowflakes. I mean snowstorm snowflakes.
She's a funny, funny lady. We got a funny, funny lady of sorts, the biggest penis in town, as our mayor, too. It takes a similar attitude toward first responders. It's very interesting. Police and fire. And what's Eric Adams doing? The announcement yesterday that Kyrie Irving can play again for the Brooklyn Nets. But the vax mandate's still in force for first responders. So the kajillion-dollar professional basketball player can go back to work. Sans compliance. The honkies on the police and fire, maybe not so much. And that's big city, big blue city America. lawless big blue city America. Uh-huh. Is it that the kind of stuff? The Michelle Wu's and the Leah Thomas's and the continuing to double and triple and quadruple down on identitarianism, will that continue to be the unraveling of the left as we lead into November? For more on that topic, we're pleased to be joined by Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride and contributor to The American Spectator. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
So what about sort of the uneven treatment based on, you know, your value to leftist politicians? Do you think that the hypocrisy of politicians like Gavin Newsom, even though he survived his recall, the disparate treatment, I'm talking about Kyrie Irving, who, by the way, I'm fine with what he did, but still, Kyrie Irving gets to go back to work. This is about Eric Adams, not Irving. He gets to go back to work. Police and fire, similarly situated, maybe not so much. Is that what's going to be the undoing, highlighting the sort of hypocrisy, who's in and who's out, or is it something else?
Well, I think that certainly will contribute to what's going to happen this fall. The results of that style of governance, I think, will also contribute to. I mean, the thing about today's modern Democrat Party is that it's a party by and for people who are incapable of doing a proper job at honest work. And you see this like in every institution that these people dominate. They're awful at everything, and they spread misery like very thickly across the populace. And, eventually when you suck, people will turn you out of your job. And I think that this, November is likely to be a very significant demonstration of that, because let's face it, it's not that the Republican Party is doing anything to earn these, positive poll numbers. This is all about a rejection of the hard left that has taken over the Democrat Party and, the inability to do anything. I mean, these people don't come from, engineering or medicine or any of these, type of vocations where it really matters whether you're good at your job, and it shows.
So, the old saw in politics is if your opponent is busy destroying himself, don't interrupt. But is that true? Right. Is that true in this case? Should you not interrupt what the Democrats are doing across the range of issues? Does the Republican Party not have to do anything except get out of the way?
Well, that's kind of the debate going on within the Republican Senate caucus, right? There, there's the Mitch McConnell, do nothing attitude. And I think the big part of what McConnell is saying, we're not going to come up with a contract for America type thing that Newt Gingrich did in 1994. We're going to do any of that. All we've got to talk about is how bad Biden is and they're going to give us the Senate majority. I don't think he's wrong about that. And of course, the other side of this is Rick Scott, who put out an 11-point.
Yeah,
I think he's calling it the Rescue America plan, which I've read through it, and it's great. It's really good stuff. How much of it you can actually accomplish, I don't know, but I don't mind these guys trying. It's about, are you worthy of the power the American people are going to give you, or are they, they're just going to give it to you, and then, 2 years from now or 4 years from now, everybody's like, yeah, well, the Republicans are no better. I'm on the Rick Scott side of that, but I can certainly understand from the standpoint of just winning the November election. I can't argue that McConnell's correct over the course of, look, if we just sit still and or act like it's Halloween and we're kids trick or treating and just open the bag and let people pour candy in, they'll do it. I don't think he's wrong about that. But what I'm looking to see, and I've got a book that's coming out in May that pretty much talks about this. I want to see a political realignment. I don't want to just see, a good election cycle. I want the Democrat Party, as it's currently constituted, to die. And I think if you're the thing that's standing in the way of that is the Republican Party isn't good enough to like start a new political era that it dominates. And it's long past time for the GOP to be that. It hasn't really been that since Reagan.
Do you see, though, because of Ron DeSantis's ascension in part,
yep,
that there are more Republicans, even those less inclined to be as aggressive as DeSantis, that are willing to start wading into these cultural battles over school curricula, women, men and women's sports, and these other matters because they see that there's real political opportunity there?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. The thing about the culture war is, you know, for most of our lives, it's the religious right that was kind of all by themselves trying to fight that, right? And they lost, I mean, pretty badly. But the thing about losing the cultural fight in the 80s and the 90s and, you know, first decade of this century is the battle lines of the culture war have shifted to such an extent that, you know, Joe Rogan is on the conservative side.
Right.
You know, like Dave Rubin is on the conservative side. And that's a like really untenable position for the left to be in. I mean, there's a 6'4" dude who's obviously a dude beating the hell out of the girls in the, you know, NCAA swim meet, and the whole country, you know, which didn't really have like a poster child for what this, you know, trans sports thing was. And now they do. And they're horrified. And, you know, politically, you look at this and it's like, you know, how can a party get out, you know, that far out over its skis and then try to defend it? I mean, I don't understand why there aren't tons of Democrat politicians saying, well, I'm not that far left. I don't understand why they're not doing it. But you're right. They've been doubling down. And I just don't think it's tenable. So the culture war is a great thing for the Republicans right now because they're actually occupying the center of America on an issue that's 75-25, if not better. You know, of course you're going to press this advantage. Why wouldn't you? I mean,
All that they can come back with, is more of the same in terms of identitarianism and the casting everybody who is not them as suffering from all the phobias and engaging in all the isms. But that starts to lose its currency when you have Nicole Hannah-Jones saying that tipping is a legacy of slavery. I think that I just don't think that's going to be enough for the left. And then also,
yeah, you just lost all the waiters when you did that, right?
I would think, and valets and everybody else. But the other piece they have, and they're still using, is Trump. And I wonder how effectively you think they can run on January 6th and deplorables, and we need to, you know, these people that are trying to take back power in Congress are, you know, the legacies of Trump. It's his party. These are his people. You don't want to go back to those bad old days.
Right. Well, you know, the thing of it is, DeSantis makes that harder, like, all the time because, you know, and look, if Trump wants to run in 24 and, you know, I think he's the nominee if he wants to run, and I'm good with that. I don't think the Democrats have anybody in 24 who can beat Trump. But, you know, what I fantasize about is Ron DeSantis, because DeSantis is a Trump 2.0. with all the bugs worked out of the system.
Yeah.
Like the guy is so smooth and so clean and so clear when he jumps in on something. I mean, it had to be the fact that, you know, the second place finisher in whatever one it was, the 500 meter or whatever, was a girl from Sarasota, Florida, right? Like that had to be the case, so that Ron DeSantis could go and put out a proclamation that says, you know,
she won. Yeah.
The real winner of that swimming race was Emma Wayan, who's from Sarasota. So we're going to proclaim that she's the NCAA champion. And it's like, oh, it's terrible that DeSantis said that. And the whole country's like, no, he's right. Whereas if Trump had said that, he would have found a way to irritate people that actually agree with it. You know, and I'm saying that, like, you know, Trump is often more entertaining than DeSantis, but from a political communication standpoint, the way DeSantis handled that is, like, I don't know how you beat that. I mean, they've said everything under the sun that they could think of on DeSantis, and they haven't laid a glove on this guy because he's never out over his skis.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I'm in complete agreement. He is the rare politician because he's actually, you know, engaged in the day-to-day and because he has the requisite skill sets that doesn't just take positions and wave a flag. He explains, because he knows what he's doing, he explains the basis for which decisions are being made so he can advance the flag. And I don't think a lot of people pick up on that distinction, but it's a massive distinction. And it's the rare politician who can do that and do it effectively. And he's just been brilliant in Florida, which is why, by the way, I mean, the latest polling has him up 20 points for his reelection in a state that 5 minutes ago was a swing right. state.
Well, and, you know, and the things that they've done behind the scenes in Florida that nobody's really talking about. I mean, he's doing party building in Florida such that it's going to be really hard for the Democrats to win major elections in that state again. You know, like, they went down to Miami and they scrubbed the voter rolls and, like, they did all the things that you don't really talk about in political communications. It's just a governing thing, and it's changed that state.
Yeah.
And you know, those are, like, you know, Trump did a lot of complaining before the fact on, you know, well, they're going to rig the election or whatever. It's like, no, you're the president of the United States. It's your job to make sure that the structure of our elections, you know, is not skewed to the point that you can't win reelection. Right. I mean, you know, he talked about it, but, like, DeSantis is the guy who does it. And the point of bringing up DeSantis in a response to your question about, you know, kind of Trump derangement syndrome, that's the only thing the Democrats have working for him, is that Ron DeSantis's popularity and example for other Republican politicians eliminates the ability to press this case that, oh, this is all Trump. And it's like, well, actually, there's another guy we like even better than Trump. And it's the same kind of politics and the same policy agenda, which actually pre-existed Trump and didn't have a home in the party until he came along and, you know, kind of threw the money changers from the temple, so to speak, by getting rid of Bush Republicanism.
What,
you know, because yeah. the only reason the Democrats were able to gain any purchase after, as you know, as bad as they had been running the country in the days of, you know, Jimmy Carter and whatnot, is that you had an exceptionally weak Republican Party whose pundits were bought off by the left, whose politicians basically were stooges of corporate America as it was, you know, building things in China rather than in, you know, Elmira, New York. You know, that party deserved to get, you know, beat over and over and over again in elections. Now the Democrats are the ones that deserve to get beat. And guys like DeSantis are sort of showing the way the Republican Party doesn't quite suck anymore.
The other thing,
you know, if you look at candidates yeah. in House races, Senate races and so forth, all of the new Republicans are much more. You can call them Trumpy if you want, but, you know, they're DeSantis's, or some of them are kind of Ted Cruz-y. Like, Josh Hawley is more of a sort of a, I call it a revivalist Republican. And there are very few, you know, budding Mitch McConnells out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the direction the party is moving in, which is better than it was for 20, 30 years before Trump came along.
One other secret weapon for the movement, which, you know, which animates the party, at least that's how it should be, the conservative movement culturally, that you wrote about recently, in this era of, you know, meme politics, the Babylon Bee, Seth Dillon, the Babylon Bee, the secret weapon of ridiculing the cultural elites in an effective and entertaining way, and the space that the Babylon Bee is filling.
The thing about the left is they're ridiculous, and so they must be ridiculed. You know, your mayor is utterly ridiculous. I mean, you know, and the you know, the fact that people are calling her Beetlejuice, I think, is like the funniest thing that I've ever heard.
Among
right?
other things. Yeah.
You know, and, right. And there's other ones that are good, too. Like I said, they call her Baby Groot, which I think is hysterically funny. All right. But you have to do that to these people because there's really no other way to respond. You can get mad, but nobody wants to listen to people who are angry and rant and rave. So, you know, you have to make a joke out of these guys. And, the Babylon Bee is so good at that that, you know, they are now fact-checking the Babylon Bee on social media. And it's like...
Fact-checking
okay,
satire.
It's a satire site, and you're fact-checking it, which means that
it's agreed
that what they're saying is true.
Yeah, yeah. And also that they're having an impact. So we need to see what we can do about defenestrating them. Absolutely. Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to The American Spectator. And Scott, we'll look forward to having you back on to promo your book when you're ready to go.
Yes, sir. Have a good one, Dan.
Thanks, Scott. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and boy, I love these two stories about what's happening in K-12 education on opposite sides of the country, one in California and the other in Florida. In California, Peachy Keenan, we've referenced her before, she's a contributor over at Claremont Institute. I'm hearing in Brentwood that prestigious private school in L.A., Brentwood School. Hearing that Brentwood is in chaos after almost zero white seniors got into University of California schools. When friends went there in happier times, University of California acceptance was like 80%. This year, it's BIPOC kids only. Parents who spend $60,000 a year for 6 years are a little upset. And she goes on. Cry more, no mercy. They made their bed. Enjoy Santa Monica community, rich kids. Love it. Absolutely love it. This is who you said you were. And so your kid cedes his spot to a kid with a higher intersectionality score. That's the way you said it works. What's the problem? Enjoy Santa Monica community, rich kids. Oh, no, mom and dad aren't going to get the status they wanted for the kid. Maybe they can call one of those consultants and see if they can, you know, dummy up a 23andMe test result like they dummy up their kids' participation on lacrosse teams and so forth. Varsity Blues style. Now, on the happier side, the other side, the sane side of the country, as presented by Governor DeSantis in Florida. On Tuesday, DeSantis signed a bill requiring all Florida kids to take and pass a basic financial literacy course to graduate from high school. Worth half a credit, the course will be required beginning in the 23-24 school year, providing a foundation for students to learn about the basics of money management, understanding debt, understanding how to balance a checkbook, understanding the fundamentals of investing. Brilliant. Thank you. Basic financial literacy at the K-12 level, making it a requirement to get out of high school in Florida. A tale of two directions K-12 is going. California and other identitarian adult leftist states. And the big cities within them that drive these policies. And states like Florida, with the leadership of Ron DeSantis, who's actually interested in making K-12 education about educating children and preparing them for success in professional life, as opposed to using K-12 as an incubator for political activists. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Roger Rehm. He's the president of the Fund for American Studies and the Foundation for Teaching Economics, Speak of the Devil. I'm a TFAS grad, Comparative Political and Economic Systems, back 100 years ago. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Dad and Amy.
How about that decision by DeSantis? Financial literacy. You got to pass a financial literacy, know how to balance a checkbook before you leave high school.
Oh, that sounds, I was just really thrilled to hear that news. You know, a lot of our focus in our high school programs is teaching what we call the economic way of thinking. It's economic principles. It's not exactly financial literacy, but I think the two go hand in hand, and we need to teach both to high school students. The challenge is always finding teachers who are prepared to teach financial literacy and teach economics. So we do a lot of training of teachers. But we need, I think there are now, say, I think it's close to 30 states in our country. Nevada recently also joined this list of states that require students to take some economics or financial literacy classes. So as long as they're trained teachers who can teach it, it's a great development because young people need to learn this.
Yeah, an important note about training the teachers that are so they're able to as well, because they come up in systems where you don't have to pass an economics course. You don't have to have any particular basic financial literacy. And so they need to be prepared to pass that along as well. It makes perfect sense.
Go ahead. I was going to say, we also developed a curriculum for teachers, a lesson for teachers, a program that's on debt and deficits, so they understand the federal and state financial problems. And they're very interested in that course because their pensions are so often at risk. And you know that in Illinois, of course, but
yes,
even nationally, we've got such terrible debt and deficit problems that we think it's important for teachers to understand what lies ahead in terms of federal spending and the terrible financial problems we're heading toward.
How about even understanding the basics, like what the difference between a deficit and debt is, which most,
exactly.
Which a lot of people don't understand, including the adult side, much less the student side. Just a comment on the tragic news out of Brentwood, the Brentwood school there in L.A., and emphasis, and we're talking about this in the context of a Supreme Court nominee as well, the emphasis on race or gender versus academic ability when it comes to entrance into elite institutions.
That's exactly right. There is, because of the progressive left pushing identity politics and what they call social justice, it is displacing what this country was built on in terms of merit and competence. Everyone, I think, would agree that if you're going to go under a surgeon's knife, you hope that surgeon is there, not because of his skin color or some arbitrary criteria, but because he's competent, was well-trained, worked hard, and got to where he was through merit. You get on an airplane, you think the same thing about the pilots. But unfortunately, the progressive left, that's not what matters. And for President Biden to say, I'm going to pick my running mate because of her skin color or her gender, I'm going to pick my Supreme Court justices based on their gender and skin color, is not what this country was built on. It's inconsistent with the idea of individual dignity and Martin Luther King's whole crusade for civil rights wasn't to have a society based on race and color.
Talking about individual liberty globally, we had on last year during the pandemic a couple of gentlemen from Venezuela that were talking about what it was like to live under Chavez and then Maduro, what's happened to their country at the hands of autocrats. And you recently received an email that you wrote about from a young woman in Ukraine who is in a bomb shelter in Kharkiv. And it's just incredible thinking about this. An email from a woman in a bomb shelter in Kharkiv asking if you could extend the deadline for your program's admission to her because, you know, she's got a little problem at home.
Yeah, well, since the early 90s, we've been running a summer program in Prague in the Czech Republic for young people throughout the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries, including students from Russia and Ukraine and all around that region. And we get some great, young, bright students who have many grew up under communism, or at least their parents did. And they come to our program and learn about the American political and economic system and gain, you know, their confidence as leaders. And this young woman emailed us recently. She said she was applying to our program this summer, but because she's in a bomb shelter in Kharkiv, she wondered if we could extend the deadline and whether we could waive a requirement that she try to find her professor to get a letter, her transcript or letter of recommendation to us.
And of course, you denied her because you said, you know, the application is the application.
Rules are rules.
Yeah,
no.
Right.
I told our staff, you know, tell her she has a full scholarship if she gets Prague this summer. And we're also trying to recruit some Ukrainian students who are here in the U.S. now studying. And otherwise, at the end of the semester in May, they would be having to try to head back to Ukraine to get home. And we'd be happy to have them in our program here this summer in Washington to learn about democracy and free markets and spend the summer with us gaining experience here because – yeah, we hope we don't know if we'll get many young men from Ukraine this summer to Prague because they're probably going to stay and fight the Russians. But we'll try to get as many kids from Ukraine as we can. We've been told by the Czech Republic, by our university partner there, they will not allow Russians to come. So we don't have to make that decision ourselves because it'd be difficult this summer to have Russians in the program.
Yeah.
Because of the conflicts that would raise, if any even did want to come. And there are a lot of good young Russian students have come to our program and do not agree with what their government's doing.
Yeah, no, it's unfortunate. I mean, it really is something, and these that's why these programs are so great. And I was just thinking Kharkiv too. There was that story out this week about a guy in his 90s who was killed in the bombing of civilian apartment buildings in Kharkiv, who had survived 4 Nazi concentration camps as a teenager. And then he's killed in a bomb by a bombing or authorized by another autocrat some 7.5 decades later. It's just one of these, like, you know, man's inhumanity to man bookended that guy's life. And it just reminds you of the sort of constant fight, the eternal vigilance that Reagan referred to that's required when it comes to when it comes to authoritarian or totalitarian regimes.
That's right. Well, you know, we have graduates of this program of ours in Prague who one is the Czech permanent representative to the UN. Another is the Polish permanent representative to the UN. They both spoke on behalf of the resolution condemning Russia a few weeks ago when this started. And they spoke with such moral clarity. We were so proud to hear them speaking to the General Assembly on behalf of Ukraine and ending this violence. The deputy minister of the Czech Republic to the EU, likewise, is a graduate of our program. And we've got alums from this program who are reporting on what's happening there, who are helping refugees in Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, opening up their homes to them. So young people, we have a lot, you know, great examples of young people in this world doing great things. I think they're an inspiration to all of us. And I hope young people in the U.S. are taking note of that. You know, when you talked about some of the things we see on U.S. campuses today, it's been a topic you've covered about law schools shouting down speakers and University of Virginia this week, the school paper unanimously editorializing against free speech. It was just disgusting when they want to keep Mike Pence from coming. These are so-called future journalists.
Yeah,
that don't believe in the First Amendment.
Future lawyers and judges and maybe Supreme Court justice as Yale Law School doing the same thing.
Yeah, but I think we can take heart that there are lots of young people in this country and elsewhere around the world who have good character and strong ideals and are doing good things, and hopefully we can turn them into the leaders of tomorrow.
He is Roger Rehn, president of the Fund for American Studies, Foundation for Teaching Economics. TFAS.org is the mothership website. Roger, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
So good to be with you, Dan.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Kyrie Irving gets to play ball again in New York City.
I had no idea. Congratulations.
Yeah.
What happened?
Now, with respect to the vax mandates for police and fire, those are still in force.
In New York and here in Chicago still.
Right. So.
And there's a new lawsuit trying to stop that.
As we mentioned earlier in the program, there's one set of rules here when it comes to professional athletes, just as we saw for 2 years, one set of rules when it comes to politicians, the faces of our cities and states, and another set of rules for the hoi polloi. And that also includes, even in big pharma companies, interesting report in realclearinvestigations.com about one such pharma company that hasn't gotten a lot of ink during the pandemic, Eli Lilly. And for more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Clayton Fox, who's a former Tablet Fellow who has been published in Tablet, the LA Magazine, Brownstone Institute, realclearinvestigations.com. Clayton, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And so offer in this piece some poignant anecdotes. We've heard a lot of those over the last 2 years about longtime Eli Lilly employees who had to choose between what they thought was in their best interest medically or what was a matter of conscience versus their job, like Mandy Van Gorp.
Yeah, I spoke to more than 12 former employees and a couple, current employees who obviously couldn't be named. And to their credit, one of them came to us. We did not seek out the story. They brought it to us. And were very brave, a lot of them, in deciding to go on the record. Initially, a lot of them were sort of hesitant, as you might imagine, because, we live in a pretty fractious time and people really gang up on you based on your personal choices. And so ultimately, as you can see, several people did come on the record and were willing to share what happened with us. I mean, just in brief, and people are, I encourage you to go read the piece at realclearinvestigations.com. But, in summary, the company on August 12th, 2021, totally reversed their initial sort of position, which was that they were not going to require company-wide mandates and issued essentially a company-wide mandate that had few paths around it, right? They told everyone, for example, well, you can apply for a religious exemption if you have a sincere religious exemption to getting vaccinated. And so a lot of people applied and were approved. But in the case of salespeople, for example, or anyone at the company who had a quote-unquote customer-facing role, meaning they had to interact with customers, once their religious accommodation was approved, it came with a note in that same email saying, well, but you also see customers face-to-face, so actually you're going to need to seek a non-customer-facing role inside the company or you will be fired on November 15th.
Did the company consider natural immunity, or if somebody had COVID, did that impact any shape or form this policy they had in place?
Very good question. So several of the employees we interviewed who were given religious or medical accommodation, primarily religious, did have proof of COVID antibodies at the time they were fired. And in one case, at least, the woman in question actually had been part of an internal program at Lilly where every 3 months she was getting tested for antibodies to contribute to their research. So the company did their own testing, knew she had antibodies, and fired her anyway because, according to Lilly, natural immunity was not sufficient for a safe workplace.
And, this persists in some places. Of course, we see the relaxation of these mandates and so-called mitigations. But you still have the D.C. press corps beating the drum, even now, as that sad little man, Tony Fauci, says, it's unlikely we'll see another wave. But New York Magazine, yesterday, it's not over. An infectious disease doc, Abrar Karan at Stanford, says we don't know what might be coming next. And we need to prepare. We need to be resilient enough and nimble enough to reimpose these mandates that were ineffectual by just about every measure if there is another, you know, Omicron part two?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been sort of on the COVID beat now for quite a while, and so I feel pretty intimately aware of the ins and outs of the pandemic, including the fact that, yeah, there probably will be more waves, right? The virus isn't going anywhere. Obviously, all of the measures we took to, quote unquote, eradicate it did not work. It has not been eradicated. It's traveling quite freely throughout the world. So sure, you know, in one form or another, it will be back. But the question we have to address then, and this is specifically vis-a-vis the Lilly story, right, is, you know, what country do we live in? Because I was under the impression that it was a country in which we had, you know, religious and medical freedom. If that is the case, then it doesn't really matter if there's subsequent waves of, you know, SARS-CoV-2 for the next 20 years. That doesn't justify people with sincere objections to a vaccine being fired, humiliated, and run out of town. That's just my opinion, but right. I think, you know, we need to be like pretty clear-eyed about like what country we live in.
And also the impact of the rush to, as you say, marginalize, embarrass, demoralize people. And then as we've seen with some medical institutions, oh, you can come back now.
Yeah.
And what that does to the morale of the workforce in, you know, in important sectors like public safety or public health.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the doctors I've corresponded with over the last several months are experts in public health. Now, granted, everyone's a quote unquote expert in public health. So I suppose
We're all epidemiologists now. Right. Yeah.
Well, no, but even the epidemiologists, right, argue about who's really the expert. Well, no, I'm really the expert because I went to Iowa. Well, I went to Harvard. I mean, it's completely insane. They're all insane. But what some of the doctors I spoke with who I trust have been saying for many months now is that this sort of blanket, everybody has to take the vaccine, man, woman, child, regardless of, one woman I spoke to at Eli Lilly has multiple sclerosis, okay? Mm. She was denied a medical exemption on that basis.
Oh my God.
Okay, this isn't, you know, MS is not a joke, right? And she was very concerned about her health because the sort of effects of the vaccine on people with autoimmune conditions has, you know, at that point at least, had not been thoroughly documented. And so they denied her medical exemption. So to your point, you know, some of the epidemiologists I've spoken with are like, they must realize, or maybe they don't realize, you know, the CDC, that their behavior now is destroying public health for generations. Because you're taking people like that who probably more or less trusted you their whole lives, then you're telling them, you have multiple sclerosis, but that doesn't count as an objection to vaccination, and that person is never going to trust you again.
You know, something else, too, the example you gave, you were talking about what kind of country, asking the question, what kind of country do we live in when it comes to personal health decisions, when it comes to conscience, rights of conscience. This email that Lilly HR sent out, if Catholic, please ensure the documentation addresses the determination of the Vatican's doctrinal office that it is morally acceptable for Catholics to receive the COVID-19 vaccines. So they're saying if you want a religious exemption and you're Catholic, you have to explain why you disagree with the Vatican, which, oh, by the way, shows their ignorance of Catholicism. But it's still, so now you want to have a theological discussion with your HR department? I'm happy to. But it's not going to go well for them. Regardless of their lack of understanding that, you know, the papal infallibility does not extend outside the catechism to matters of vaccines and labor economics and climate policy and all the other things the Pope weighs in on. But I digress, because the real point is you want an environment in corporate America where you're having a theological discussion with some HR representative and your job is on the line?
Well, right. Precisely. And I hope we captured sort of that insanity that these employees were put through. And that was the main sort of feeling that, you know, in speaking with them, most of them had, right? It wasn't that they didn't understand completely why it was happening, although, of course, that was also true. It was the manner in which it was all conducted. It was conducted in such a sort of disjointed, unequal way. Catholics were being asked for one thing. Non-Catholics were being asked for other forms of documentation. There wasn't an equal standard. Like I said, people with multiple sclerosis were denied medical, you know, and then some people who were denied medical went back and said, okay, you're denying medical. Well, I also hold sincere religious objections to vaccination. I didn't want to reveal that because those, you know, religious objections to vaccination and or abortion, you know, are often marginalized in our society. And I didn't want you, my company, my employer, to know my religious objection. But now I'm going to appeal on that basis. And then the company very coldly responded to those people with, well, you missed the deadline for application, so we won't even review your religious request.
So what happened to the people that you interviewed for your article? Are they still with Eli Lilly? Have some stayed? Have some moved on?
Mostly not. Mostly have moved on. Some have found new jobs. Some have not. Some are in a process of, you know, seeking legal action against the company. Some cannot because they accepted a severance agreement. Which sort of forbid them from ever seeking legal recourse. But, you know, they had to do it because they needed the money. They have big families, kids in college, et cetera. And, you know, one woman broke down on the phone with me crying, and we didn't get this in the story. And she said, you know, please don't forget about the people, my coworkers. She knew at least 12 coworkers. And that's in addition to the 12 in the story. So just to be clear, she said, I knew at least 12 people who got vaccinated against their will in order to keep their job at Lilly, and none of them, you know, they were all very scared or felt they violated they'd gone against their own convictions. You know, she was very upset at the people who actually ultimately did take the vaccine in order to keep their job.
Oh, it's so sad. I mean, it's sad. Parents are sad, too, when they have to vaccinate their kids so that they don't have to be quarantined in school, too. But, Dan, what were you saying?
Well, and what is Eli Lilly's policy going forward to the extent you know? Have they now relaxed the vax mandate, or are they going to be requiring boosters here as the next phase?
Yeah, well, we wish they would have responded to our very detailed request for information. They did respond, but it was a boilerplate response. They did not address our specific questions, of which that was one. What I can tell you, and again, this did not make it in the piece, is that the people who were given a religious or medical accommodation who work at headquarters in Indianapolis, the rules for them as of November 15th were that they had to still wear a mask, they still had to keep 6 feet of distance when possible, and they were only allowed to take off their mask if they were in a closed room with the door closed. So after November 15th at Eli Lilly headquarters in Indianapolis, you had a situation where essentially unvaccinated employees who had been given accommodation were singled out and marked publicly, and everyone else was able to resume business as usual with no social distancing and no masking. So when you talk about humiliation, I really can't think of anything more extreme than that in the workplace. I mean, it's like wearing a dunce cap.
Yeah, ascientific-based humiliation, too. Clayton Fox, former Tablet Fellow, published in Tablet, LA Magazine, Brownstone Institute, and Real Clear Investigations. That's where you can find his piece on Eli Lilly that we were talking about, which we'll tweet out. A pharma giant imposed follow the mandate on vaccine objectors. They are now ex-workers. Excellent piece. Clayton Fox, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, maybe we'll pick this up on the other side of Mike Scott's newscast, too. It's a big issue, quite literally. A plus-size model, which is a size 14, as I understand it. That's disclosed, by the way. Yeah.
14's not too bad.
Remy Bader.
Do you have a picture?
I have a picture of her trying to get the seatbelt on Delta Airlines around her girth, and she was unable to do so. She posted this. And slammed Delta for scrawny seatbelts that don't fit around her waist. Delta figured out, she wrote.
Uh-huh.
I shouldn't need to ask for an extender. It should just be easy. And being a size 14, she said, should not warrant an extension. I didn't even know these seatbelt extension things existed.
Oh, yeah. You ask for them when you get on the plane.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they actually run out of seatbelt extenders. And that's when you know you might want to get off the plane.
We got some data on this, too. Delta seatbelts range from 40 to 45 inches.
Okay.
As compared to American Airlines and JetBlue's seatbelts, which are 45 to 47 inches.
Okay.
But Southwest.
What do we got? 55?
Which I fly all the time. Those clocks, those seatbelts clock in at just 39 inches.
Ooh.
I've never had a problem.
Well, look at you. You're svelte. You've been doing Pilates. Well, you've got abs of steel, which you're going to show off tonight at the roast.
And buns.
Yeah. We're going full throttle,
got
Dave.
Both. Uh-huh. I got, upstairs and downstairs. I got all the... so here's the thing. She brought it up. Not me. And she's making a big thing about it. And she's got a big following on TikTok or Instagram or both. So that makes her important and her opinion important, apparently. So this seatbelt issue on airlines, is that a thing? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. We'll get your views on that at 8:38.
And then people think I'm fat shaming again, which I'm not, because this is a real issue now that the plus size model brought it up.
Right.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so now that people are flying again, and maybe someday in the not-too-distant future can do some mass-free, this issue of, fat people on planes again comes up because this plus-size model...
Oh, what's her name again? I'm going to Google her.
Remy Bader. She's upset with Delta because she couldn't fasten herself in. She's a size 14, she says.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, that's her theme music.
Size 14 is not that big. I mean, the average size of a woman is between, I think it's 10 to 12. So size 14.
Yeah, and it probably jumped to a 14 during COVID as everybody packed on the pounds.
And drank their faces off.
She said that Delta's new planes have way shorter seatbelts than they did before.
Oh, so it's the plane's fault.
No, the seatbelts got shorter. Remy, is that what happened? You didn't get wider. The seatbelt got shorter.
How do you spell this chick's name?
Isn't that what they say, like in Eaters Anonymous meetings? How do you spell Remy? R-E-M-I.
Thank you. Sorry to bother you with facts.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm trying to see what she looks like. No, I'll decide if she's fat or not.
I know. Hersey didn't offer phonics. I got it. Neither did Iowa. Way shorter seatbelts than they did before. She said when she confronted the flight attendant about the problem, she was told to ask for an extender, a device that adds 35 inches to a seatbelt. Holy cow.
Oh, she's huge.
Should commercial flights really be carrying around that kind of cargo? That's more for FedEx, isn't it? She said the suggestion to ask for an extender made her feel embarrassed, like there's clearly something wrong with me. There is something wrong with you. The seatbelt doesn't fit.
And she is not, I repeat, not a size 14. That is a 24 maybe. Or maybe an 8. Well, she is, there's no, I mean, come
on. She goes
and she's
sitting down again.
Well,
630 text. I was on a Southwest flight last month where they had to remove two people from the flight because the plane was overweight.
Right. Do you understand that there was a flight that
crashed?
That's
why she was flying Delta. She couldn't fly Southwest.
There was a flight, American Airlines flight out of Charlotte once. It was one of those smaller, I think it was a CRJ-40, you know, the smaller airplanes. What?
Okay, Johnny Quest. Go ahead. Yeah.
And it,
aviation expert.
No, but it crashed because of the weight of the passengers. You have to, they were all obese on the plane. It's either jet fuel or passenger weight. So you have to have a balance between the two, and they didn't, and they crashed.
They chose to jettison the jet fuel?
They weren't.
I mean, look, as a, you don't think about this on a commercial flight, but just as like a private pilot, you fly like a little Cessna Skyhawk like I do.
Yeah.
Weight is a huge issue. Like,
huge.
Right? And so the same principles apply to these huge commercial carriers. It's just obviously the numbers are so much more massive, but and you come up with sort of an average weight for per passenger and an average weight for the luggage and whatever else they're the cargo that these commercial flights carry and so on and so forth. So it is a real thing, particularly if, you know, you're budgeting for whatever, 200 pounds a seat for men and 150 pounds for women or whatever the numbers are. And, you know, you're coming in at 250, 275 and 225 and so on and so forth. But I mean, the whole thing, too. I mean, if you can't, you know, though this we've talked about this before in the whole like, you know, at what weight do you have to buy two seats because you're spilling over into your seatmate.
Right.
Or, you know, or buy your own plane or.
Well, it's happened. I mean, I've been
or
scrunched.
Or be put on a trailer and, you know,
yeah.
and over the road trucked to your destination.
My mom had to change seats with somebody recently because she was in between two obese people and she's on oxygen. She has portable oxygen and she couldn't breathe. And so she had to get the flight attendant. She had to move and change seats with someone. It's a problem. And if you're that big, if you're spilling over into the seat next to you, they should force you to buy two seats.
I just, the whole thing is like, you know, like, look, you know, if you're, what's the term we use now? Plus size. I love these terms. You know, if you're fat. I mean, as a, if you're fat, you know you're fat. It's fine. No, nobody wants to beat you up or put you in a gulag. It's fine. But I just recognize it and just sort of like, you know, be... deal with it. Be accommodating. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you're 7 feet tall, these airlines aren't great for your comfort level
no,
either and
not.
For your legroom and so forth. Hey, I mean, that those are the brakes. This is how it works. This is how we set up our the machinery used to run our business. You know, if you're sort of an anomaly, then there may be some complications. What can I tell
you? Well, there's a Japanese airline where they force everyone to go to the bathroom first before you get on the plane because that helps with passenger weight. They do. And then there was talk of, too, paying money for a ticket based on your weight. Like, you, if you're fatter,
yeah,
you pay more money
yeah.
because you're going to, you know, drain the fuel costs.
Yeah, but then you have to start to, well, they do that. I mean, they do that by luggage, right? If your luggage is over 50 pounds and you, in
you
some airlines.
You got to take that stuff out.
Or you pay more for
right.
it. So there's some,
that always makes me nervous when I see people with, like, 120-pound bag.
So if
you're going to bring us all down with
if
that
your extra 120 pounds is your caboose, then what's the difference? Why not pay more for that? Just like you have to pay more if you've got, you know, 25 clubs in your golf bag and it's 75 pounds on some airlines. Yeah, they do. You know, I mean, everybody does their pricing differently. Fine. I just like this. This is complaining about it. Delta, figure it out, you know, and her like, I can't get this. I mean, it's sort of embarrassing that she would post this and use this to.
Just
so she was somehow wronged in this.
She wasn't wronged, and the airline's not wrong. And just ask for the seatbelt extender. Because guess what? You need it to stay safe. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line.
Will and Skokie are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I'm 6'8", and I love Southwest because they let you buy up, and you can usually buy the exit row seats or, you know, one of the two exit row seats, and that way you got the extra room. But you know, they should make that a priority. If like you're over 6 foot, then you get priority for those seats.
Or you can pay for it.
Like you do.
You can pay for it.
What you do. I pay $40 extra. I get, I bump up on the line, you know, they have priority seating. Sometimes I hate it when I get on there and there's some little guy who's sitting there and I go, come on, dude, come on. Can we trade? No, I want this seat. Okay, fine. But
you
know.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Will. And if you don't want a cleanse on colon blow airlines that Amy was talking about, then you pay extra for that. Make you go to the bathroom before you get out of the plane.
Yeah.
Come on.
Take out that excess weight. Why not? You'll save on fuel costs. You won't burn as much fuel if the plane is lighter. You know that. You're a pilot.
Yeah.
Get with it, Tootsie.
Yeah.
Huh?
Tony and Steger, I mean, I don't know what to say about that.
I feel sorry for the man, woman, or thing that's sitting next to her and has to deal with all the weight that's coming over the chair into my side.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't like, I'm like Francis in Stripes. I don't like people touching me or my stuff.
I know.
I'm not going to kill them, but I don't like it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I try to be respectful. I'm a little gangly. And so I try to, you know, just be as uncomfortable as I need to be to provide some separation. Mm-hmm. You know, the few times I fly commercial.
Well, oh, yes.
I have to, you know, travel with the masses, the indignity of it all. Mike and Hammond, we're going to switch gears. Well, I guess we can go to another travel thing here. By the way.
Yeah, the great gas giveaway. I'm still numb from pumping gas. I pumped gas for an entire half hour, and I did because that BP in Melrose Park, they only had two people helping out. So I was the third. And then after a half hour, I left.
Well, so why can't people pump their own gas? Are they too fat?
They don't want them to get out of their car.
What are you talking about?
You say they're too fat.
Why can't people pump their own gas all the time? Why can't they pump their gas when it's free?
I don't know why. That was one of the stipulations that you have to, somebody else has to pump your gas. I mean, that somebody, a volunteer or somebody that works
at
the gas
station. Who wants to loiter at a gas station?
I know. I was like, come on, guys, let's go.
Weird.
It was very efficient, by the way.
Speaking of which, you know, for people that are critical of Willie Wilson, this is his money, this million bucks he's providing for $50 per person of free gas. A trio of House Democrat socialists introducing the Gas Rebate Act of 2022, not a rebate, because you're not rebating anything that was paid, send Americans $100 a check in any month when the national average gas price exceeds $4 a gallon.
Oh, come on.
Dependents will get another $100.
That's not going to solve that is just the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
One of the co-sponsors, our very own Lauren Underwood.
Oh,
you know?
Is she trying to be a Spice Girl now?
So tell me again, you know, you're offended by Willie Wilson. Are you equally offended or more offended, which you should be, by Lauren Underwood wanting to spend other people's money to buy votes? You know, look, we did this for you. I engage in all these policies. I mean, this is the classic, you know, I create a problem and then I misapply the wrong remedy, to borrow from Groucho Marx. So we pursue all these policies that drive the price of gas up. But on the back end, I'm going to give you $100 a month anytime it's more than $4 average price.
God.
And I'm the hero in the story, Lauren Underwood.
Well, it was just amazing. Every person I spoke with, no one has a clue what the gas tax is per gallon.
Oh, my, of course not.
Not. And I heard, because everybody, I pumped a lot of gas, met a lot of people, and just asked, well, do you know who's doing this? Biden, Pritzker, are you upset with them? Because they're doing this. And one person said to me, well, no, this is because of Ukraine. This is because of Putin.
Are you upset with Biden and Pritzker because Pritzker doubled our gas tax?
I mean, it's not just the gas prices. It's everything in general that's going up. All your meats, all your groceries, everything's going up. So who knows who to blame? Everyone's passing the buck. Everyone's passing the blame on someone else. So what are you going to do?
What about the meter? You just said you were in Lake Geneva last weekend.
Yeah, $3.47 a gallon.
Well, but do you understand that nobody knows 72 cents a gallon?
I understand
for taxes
that.
In Illinois?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have to live here for my job. I don't have a choice.
Sounds excited
but
about
you can
being
vote
here.
Him out.
I can vote him out. Yes,
that's an option.
That
are
is
you
an
thinking
option.
About it?
Thinking about a lot of things right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know who to believe. Well, or you don't know who to blame. Well, how about start with the people in charge?
It's real simple.
Start with the people in charge and work from there.
Well, and then other people said, "Oh, it's corporate greed and the gas companies. This is all their way of making money." Are you serious, mister?
Yeah.
So you think the gas prices are high because of Ukraine?
I think the gas prices are high because the people are greedy. It's greed controlling
greed.
Things.
Yeah.
Okay. And for Ukraine.
You said earlier.
Well, the gas companies, they making money.
Oh.
You know, they controlling stuff.
Yeah, well,
mind numbing.
Should the gas companies not make money? How do you stay in business if you don't make money? Number one, sir. The other thing too about greed. I mean, Milton Friedman had the best formulation on this. Is it only gas companies that are greedy, sir? Is it only private sector companies that are greedy? Are government commissars greedy? Do you think the politicians in charge in Chicago and Illinois do things out of altruism or greed? The Lauren Underwood $100 a month, is that altruism or is that greed? The greed of her using whatever's at her disposal to try and buy off people to retain her office. all these angels in government and all these bad people, the devils that are in charge of companies like gas companies or who own gas stations. These are the bad people. And the politicians are the angels? Is that what you're saying, sir? Greed, part of the human condition, is only found in the private sector. I'd love to have a conversation with greed, about greed with some of these individuals. They just say things that they've been trained to say without any thought, that are not reflective of any understanding of what's happening. And it's unfortunate they never get called on it. It's unfortunate they never run into anybody that challenges them to engage their brain. And he's a good example of why you have the worst governed city in America in the worst governed state in American history, Chicago and Illinois, where that other gentleman, I'm forced to be here because I'm for my job. Sounds real enthusiastic about being an Illinois resident, doesn't he? Mike and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, guys. Welcome back to the show, Amy. Hey, was there any Greta Thunberg sightings there? Any signs of the protesting the promotion of use of fossil fuels? And will Willie Wilson be canceled over this?
Oh, no. Yeah, no, nobody was protesting the use of fossil fuels. No green protesters. And Willie Wilson, people love him. I mean, I just didn't realize. I mean, I know that there's poverty all around us, but people are desperate. I talked to one man who lost his job. He said, you know, I had to get this money because I need the gas to go look for another job to drive to interviews.
Yeah, and a lot of people are economically illiterate. They need to take that financial literacy course that's being required of Florida high school students, because the opportunity cost of waiting 4 hours in line for $50 in gas versus if they're hourly wage earner. You know, I might want to try to do some of that math. But, you know, Willie Wilson, it would have been interesting to ask that gentleman who talked about greed. What do you think about Willie Wilson? Oh, I love Willie Wilson. He's giving me $50 in free gas. Well, how do you think Willie Wilson could afford to give away $1.2 million in free gas in the last week? Because he ran businesses that did what, sir? They made money. Was he greedy?
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.